Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always nice to have you here. And a special welcome to all of the new listeners from all over the world. We're happy to deal with the issues that are important to you, and we try to select the topics that will impact you if you live in Iceland or Sub-Saharan Africa. If you're a rural person in the United States, a special shout-out. We're caring about the environment, the conditions in which you're trying to live each day, and also the people living in all of the urban areas as well. Today, for example, we're taking on from the Fatty Acid Research Institute in Cedars-Sinai Medical Center how when you consume the omega-3 fatty acids, you're less likely to die from COVID-19. Now, if I'm sharing this, and this is from a peer-reviewed journal, Prostaglandins, Leukotrienes, and Essential Fatty Acids, the current issue, from two very respected research institutes, and it's important dealing with COVID, shouldn't all the major media have this as headlines? Because this is something you can do that could help you not die from COVID. But the vaccine was never researched to see if it would prevent you from dying or getting seriously ill or infecting yourself or other people. Just makes it less, let's say, moderate to severe symptoms. Well, then why not take omega-3? And I'm going to get to that. So we're sharing always quality information, but the mainstream media chooses not to. From the University of Exeter today, we're going to talk about how attitude of gratitude keeps you feeling hopeful as you age. This study was in Japan. We're also going to explore how the red pigments in red peppers and oranges are linked to a lower risk of lung cancer, Tufts University. We're also going to explore how melatonin, which you normally secrete if you get a good night's sleep, regulates amyloid beta that I mentioned on yesterday's program, and that's what can cause Alzheimer's. And it also is a neurotoxin. So if you want to help lower the risk of Alzheimer's, then melatonin, and this is from Shandong University in China, and again published in a very important peer-reviewed journal, and how natural compounds found in herbs and vegetables could improve treatment for triple-negative breast cancer in women. University of Missouri. So we have a lot to share on health, but also today I'm going to do more on the environment. You're going to hear Greta Thunberg today. Everything she is saying is accurate. I support her talking about the environment because what she is saying is accurate. I do not support her family and the whole machinery behind her that have manipulated the world into thinking that they have the answers. They don't have the answers. They have the right questions. Don't conflate the two. It's like when Barack Obama was running on hope and change. Well, that didn't work. Wonderfully articulate, humorous, great personality. Now look at the consequences. So let's not conflate a great idea, timely, needed, with are we going to implement it and what type of implementation. So we're going to hear from her, then I'm going back 11 years to a keynote speech I gave at the United Nations. I was invited for the third time to do a speech there, and this one was one where I had a choice. I could either give everyone a good feeling that day by talking about how wonderful all their organizations were. The whole room was packed with hundreds of environmental organizations, and my friend Mitchell Radman was there that day, but most people in the room I had never met didn't know. And instead, I just decided to go in a different direction and tell them what we were really not doing, why, and how the environmental movement had been completely compromised. And I went into detail on that. It's about 27 minutes, but I'm only going to play the first 9 minutes. It's in two parts. Part one today, because I want to have you hear Greta Thunberg, because what she say is real, and she said it just last week at Davos. So why would Davos even allow someone who is in contempt of everything they stand for to give a talk by dressing them down? That's not by accident. That's part of the new global reset that we'll be unpacking for you to see how it's all a lie. It's all manipulation. But the average person doesn't do their homework, doesn't care. They want someone to think for them, and the Great Reset will do everything for you until you realize you're not allowed to do anything for yourself, including think or speak. And in that context, today I'm setting aside a half hour to have you listen to a gentleman who I consider one of the finest minds on the topic of the loss of individual and diversity in the wake of increasing cultural uniformity. Professor Russell Jacoby will be on today. He is a professor of history at the University of California, Los Angeles. He holds the Moshe Gonzalez Chair of Critical Thinking at the University of California, Los Angeles, where he teaches 20th century European and American intellectual history. By the way, he was featured in the documentary Velvet Prisons, Russell Jacoby on American Academia. He's published about 10 books addressing the cultural wars in education, multiculturalism, the politics of apathy, the history of violence, the decline of intellectual class, and utopian idealism. His most recent book is on diversity, The Eclipse of the Individual in the Global Era, Seven Stories Press. So, and by the way, he's earned many notable fans, including Howard Zinn, Gore Vidal. He holds degrees from the University of Chicago, University of Wisconsin, and a doctorate at the University of Rochester. He's one of America's uniquely gifted intellects. That will be live on the program today. So we begin with the latest on health and healing. Researchers with the Fatty Acid Research Institute, in collaboration with Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Orange County, California, have published the first direct evidence that higher omega-3 blood levels may reduce the risk of death from COVID infection. The report was published in the Prostaglandins, Leukotrienes, and Essential Fatty Acids current issue. Now, there are multiple papers in the medical literature hypothesizing that omega-3 fatty acids should have beneficial effects in patients with COVID-19 infection, but up until now, there have been no published peer review studies supporting that hypothesis. This study, including 100 patients admitted to the hospital with COVID-19 for whom blood admission samples had been stored, and the outcome showed that those that had the highest omega-3 fatty acids, and which impact your red blood cell membranes, had the best outcome. In fact, they were substantially, statistically significantly more likely not to die. And that's a big deal. So the takeaway message is, if you want to live a longer life, especially at a time when we are being bombarded with a lot of immunosuppressive agents, then the omega-3 fatty acids, I suggest 3,000 milligrams a day, 1,500 in the morning, and the same in the evening. One of the things that happens is that we make certain generalized assumptions that the older you get, the wiser you get. The wiser you are, the more patient you are. The more patient you are, the more gifted you are at sharing a lifetime of influence in your own life, as well as impacting others to other people. Well, unfortunately, it's not always true. In fact, with the senior citizens I've counseled, almost to a person, they have been argumentative, resistive to change, highly opinionated, frequently very prejudiced, a lifetime of holding on to misinformation and ideals and opinions, and they're going to go to their death with those unchanged, which, of course, is their right. So let us look at what it takes to open ourselves up as we age, to also open ourselves up to one of the most important gifts we can give ourselves, surrender knowledge. Now, this is a concept I created several years ago, and I hold to it today. And it was interesting because I used to do every Wednesday for 25 years when I lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, I would have dinner parties. And they were kind of like the old round table, Dorothy Parker and some of the intellects of the 1920s and 30s, 40s at the Algonquin Hotel. Well, this was where people could not talk about themselves or their work. That was off the table. But they were to talk about life and joy and happiness. And the evening was filled with wonderful human insights, lots of humor, And some of these were some of the headiest people you'd ever meet, including Nobel Prize winners, top authors and philosophers, academics, regular people who had unique insights into their own life. The one thing I noticed was that there was a sense of gratitude. They were grateful for having an opportunity to have any forum as an author, as a teacher, to share their insights. And they looked around the room, and we would, after we'd have dinner and I'd make us a vegan meal, we'd all go down and sit in this living room. And I had lots of books in there. One of the people one night said, "Gary, what do you keep all these books for?" I said, "I don't keep them." I said, "After I read a book, I take about a case of books every week downstairs, and on the corner is the guy that sells used books. I give them to him. And these are really good books." And he said, "Well, what do you do?" I said, "Well, I get new books because I have a radio show and it's a popular one. A lot of authors want to be on. I get the books. And if I want something that's very scholarly, I generally just go up to the Columbia University, the bookstore there, and I buy them. I get them fairly decent price." And he said, "Well, why do you do that?" I said, "Because since when does it say that because we're out of high school or college or graduate school or we're in a profession that we have to stop our learning? In fact, everything else was just proper preparation for the real learning, because now you're not in a controlled environment that you have some measure of ability to manipulate. You're in the real world. You don't know what's going to happen day to day, second to second. But if you don't keep your growing going, you're not going to go anywhere. Wherever you left your capacity for intellectual expansion, that's as far as you're going to grow. So why not keep growing? Read literature you appreciate and read literature you don't. So you have a diversity of ideas, but surrender it. The moment you surrender something and say, I appreciate what I've learned, the important lessons I will keep, but now I want room to challenge. That's what science is. Science should never be orthodox, because the moment science becomes orthodox and prides itself in its rigidity of thought and conformity of consensus, it ceases to be science. It becomes a new cult, a behavioral manipulation, first of oneself and then of all the patients or proctors that are in a person's life. We have to surrender knowledge in order to grow. It is not possible to do both, because you're trying to live in a dualistic world, and that's where our problems come from. So one of the things I spoke about that evening to the men and women who were at that dinner party that evening was, and it was pretty much the same people, there'd be changes anywhere from 4 to 6 people, was that everyone took a turn talking about how gratitude was so important in them appreciating that maybe they had a gift and they should give that gift to others. Well, now comes the University of Exeter, which is in the United Kingdom, a study, and it's entitled Attitude of Gratitude Keeps Older People, in this case in Japan, feeling hopeful as they age. But I believe that one truth, which is a universal truth, supersedes all political, ideological, cultural, religious, or social truths. And that's why with universal truths, you can't hurt people. You respect all life. You honor all life. You honor nature. You honor animals. You honor the block you're living on, the house you're living in, the people next door. So you're connected. The vitalism of that harmonizing, harmonic energy transcends any other boundary. And yet we live by our heavily cloistered, completely codified, limiting, and frequently self-destructive personal truths. So older people in Japan have an attitude of gratitude which keeps them feeling hopeful despite the challenges of aging, feeling thankful and grateful for the care and support they have been given during their life helps pensioners in the country to be more optimistic, even when they experience difficulties and were anxious about getting older. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Anthropology and Aging. So just remember, you can be like many of the people I've counseled or been at my anti-aging retreats of being angry at everything, and partly angry because you're getting older, and therefore you're your own self-contempt by looking in the mirror and seeing the crepey skin and the jowiness and the loss of muscle mass. And yeah, who caused that? You did, by the choices you didn't make, thinking karma doesn't apply to you. Karma is a part of every choice you make in life, and it is cumulative. You live your karma every day, whether you're aware of it or not. We are the sum total of every choice we've made, good or bad, every single morning. So when you appreciate the good choices you've made, and you focus upon the bad choices and learn the lesson, the deeper, meaningful spiritual lesson, then you're far less likely to replicate that. And it's the replication of mistakes that cause the final accumulation that causes the heart attack, the bankruptcy, the divorce, the abuse, the neglect, the betrayal, etc. Now reverse that, surrender that, and suddenly you have gratitude for all the things that have given you a chance to be at a place in life where you're able to have that freedom to be. From Tufts University, those pigments, very bright pigments, especially in red peppers, sweet red peppers, and oranges, according to Tufts University, that can lower your risk of lung cancer. Yeah, so let's just put more of the paprika and the sweet peppers and butternut squash and oranges, tangerines, and other foods like that into our diet. And it's especially good for lowering the risk of lung cancer in people who smoke. Also, I want to share this, and this is from Shandong University. Melatonin that we get when we have a good night's sleep can help a person prevent or help them if they have dementia or Alzheimer's disease. Now, let's just say you're not getting a good night's sleep. You're waking up. That breaks the melatonin secretion. So just take 2 to 4 milligrams of melatonin each day at night, about 2 hours before you go to bed. And also, from the University of Missouri, more than 100 women die from breast cancer every 24 hours in the United States. And triple negative breast cancer, which comprise about 20% of all breast cancer tumors, are particularly deadly type of breast cancer disease. It often metastasizes to distant sites. Now they're finding that lutein, L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N, L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N, lutein, a natural compound found in thyme, that's T-H-Y-M-E, and parsley, and celery, and broccoli could reduce the risk of developing metastasis originating from triple-negative breast cancer in women. Also, I was watching on Sunday when I wanted to watch, and I'll talk about this later this week, when Brady was playing for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in against Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay, in the national championship, going, the winner gets to go to the Super Bowl. At no time have I heard a single broadcast anywhere talking about what he's doing right. They keep wondering, is it this the time he should retire? He's 43. This thing, same thing for Drew Brees. And I think it's 41 or 42. Two outstanding players. But no one's talking about what does Tom Brady do to keep himself so fit and far younger biologically than his chronological years? That's the story. That's ageism. And that is palpable in our society. So I'm going to talk about what anyone could learn from athletics if they did it the right way. And I'll be going into what you can do to add some years onto your life. But in any case, the whole idea that if you're taking a lot of plants in, you're going to help yourself with all kinds of conditions. But there was an ad. There was a very tearful ad. It's a tug-on-your-heart ad about a young boy who developed cancer early in life, and he finally died at the age of 12. And you heard the mother's story, the boy's story, and he had designed some football cleats for one of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers receivers. I believe it was either one of the two teams' wide receivers. In any case, at no point did they say, was there any other therapy that could have saved that boy's life? And the answer is yes, there are many therapies. So starting next week, I'm going to be sharing complementary and alternative therapies to both prevent cancer and if you have cancer. I'm going to have some cured patients who had terminal cancer on the air to let you know it's not myth, it's real. And why aren't these alternative approaches ever discussed? It's as if, well, they died a noble death. Okay, they died. They did the best they could with what they had. That's noble. But they didn't look elsewhere. That's conditioning. So we're going to open up some conditioned minds to show you what opportunities exist. And the only people I'm having on are people I personally work with who have all their medical records. So if anyone doubts this, they're happy to show all their medical records. And same way with multiple sclerosis reversed, Parkinson's reversed. All the conditions I reverse. AIDS, 1,200 people with AIDS living with HIV, totally healthy. Not one died in the 15 years the Tri-State Healing Center was open. And 18 of them reversed their HIV condition. So we're going to start having people who reverse disease using alternative therapies. Not that that doesn't mean that all orthodox therapy doesn't have therapies that work. It does. Any therapy that can be shown to help a patient, any medication or procedure, I'm going to support and do if it meets the criteria. But if it's only creating profit for the doctor, the hospital, the pharmaceutical company, and it harms people, I'm going to challenge it. That's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break. Now, when we come back from the break, we're going to go to Greta Thunberg to hear what she has to say in the belly of the beast. She's right up there with the worst of the worst at Davos. Let me also mention that to help so many people, I was not aware until Sharon and my staff in New York told me that we have been flooded with people saying, what do we do now that New York and other states like New Jersey, California are going to mandate mandatory COVID vaccines, and they're proposing the laws, and where some cities that were once wonderful places to live, and New York was one of them, by the way. I think New York was just the greatest place I could have ever grown up in the world, but it's not now. It's changed, radically changed, and it will survive, absolutely, but it will be a different New York. And I'll explain that in depth on an upcoming program. But that's also true of Los Angeles, San Francisco. I used to love going out to San Francisco. I used to go out all the time to do lectures. And the San Francisco that I went to in the 1960s and 70s and 80s and 90s, 2000s, it's radically different today. It's a cesspool, crime-ridden, smelly, not safe. Los Angeles, the same. You can find little green zones that are nice. And I talked about the green zones coming. I did that 10 years ago. They're here. So what I'm doing is this, to help people embrace the future, honor the best of the past, and navigate an uncertain future, I'm going to do a webinar on this very topic in 2 weeks, Sunday at noon. You can go to prn.fm to get information on the webinar. And we're building a new site. It's almost complete. A lot of information is up there, not everything, GaryNall.com. We've changed a lot even in the last 24 hours. So this is all about not just the coronavirus. It's all about how can people get off the grid that is so politicized and so corporately controlled? What can you do so you're not monitored and commercialized? What you can do without being exploited? Are there safe places to live? Are there progressive communities? Where are they? What are the careers likely to be eliminated in the future, and what careers will be in demand? How can people create a new income stream? Where's the safest place to live on the planet? And should I buy? Should I rent? And what are the benefits and limitations of the intentional communities? And what are the options for living outside the United States for a better life? All this and more I'm going to be discussing in depth, plus I'll be taking an hour's worth of questions from the audience. Noon, not this Sunday, the following Sunday. I think it's around the 5th or 6th, somewhere in there of February. Anyhow, if you want to join it, they're always packed. You'll go to those sites, or if you want more information, you can call Jessica at 646-926-5422. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
And I'm not here to make deals. You see, I don't belong to any financial interest or political party, so I can't bargain or negotiate. I'm only here to once again remind you of the emergency we are in. The crisis that you and your predecessors have created and inflicted upon us. The crisis that you continue to ignore. I am here to remind you of the promises that you have made to your children and grandchildren, and to tell you that we are not willing to compromise on the very minimum safety levels that still remain. The climate and ecological crisis can, unfortunately, no longer be solved within today's systems. According to the current best available science, that's no longer an opinion. That's a fact. And we need to keep this in mind as countries, businesses, and investors now rush forward to present their so-called ambitious climate targets and commitments. The longer we avoid this uncomfortable truth, and the longer we pretend that we can solve the climate and ecological emergency without treating it like an emergency, the more precious time we will lose. And this is time we do not have. Today, we hear nations and leaders all over the world speak of an existential climate emergency. And yet, instead of taking the immediate action you would in any emergency, they set up vague, hypothetical, distant targets way into the future. Targets based on loopholes and incomplete numbers. Targets like net zero emissions 2050. Targets that equal surrender. It's like waking up in the middle of the night, seeing your house on fire, and then deciding to wait 10, 20, or 30 years before you call the fire department, while labeling those trying to wake people up alarmists. We understand that the world is complex and that change doesn't happen overnight. But you've now had more than 3 decades of blah, blah, blah. How many more do you need? Because when it comes to facing the climate emergency, the world is still in a state of complete denial. The justice for the most affected people in the most affected areas is being systematically denied. Even though we welcome every single climate initiative, the targets and commitments being presented and discussed today are very far from being enough. And the time for small steps in the right direction is long gone. If we are to have at least a small chance of avoiding the worst consequences of the climate and ecological emergency, this has to change. Because you still say one thing and then do the complete opposite. You speak of saving nature while locking in policies of further destruction for decades to come. You promise to not let future generations down while creating new loopholes, basing your pledges on the cheating tactics that got us into this mess in the first place. If the commitment of lowering all our emissions by 70%, 68%, or even 55% by 2030 actually meant they aimed to reduce the emissions on that level, that would be a great start. But that is unfortunately not the case. And since the general level of public awareness continues to be so low, our leaders can still get away with almost anything. No one is held accountable. It's like a game. Whoever is best at packaging and selling their message wins. As it is now, we can have as many meetings and summits as we want, but unless we treat the climate and ecological emergency like an emergency, no sufficient changes will be achieved. What we need to begin with is to implement annual binding carbon budgets based on the current best available science. And right now, more than ever, we are desperate for hope. But what is hope? For me, hope is not more empty assurances that everything will be all right, that things are being taken care of, and that we don't need to worry. For me, hope is the feeling that keeps you going, even though all odds may be against you. For me, hope comes from action, not just words. And for me, hope is telling it like it is, no matter how difficult or uncomfortable that may be. And again, I'm not telling you what to do. After all, safeguarding future living conditions and preserving life on Earth as we know it is voluntary. The choice is yours to make. But I can assure you this. You cannot negotiate with physics. And your children and grandchildren will hold you accountable for the choices that you make. How's that for a deal?
That's Greta Thunberg. And she is absolutely correct on each of her points. In fact, she's in the new film, Last Call for Tomorrow. And we are planning a worldwide premiere of the film over the internet in the next 60 days. I'll let you all know about it. But just to give you an idea, she was at Davos. So Davos had a panel for the Arctic on it and reducing global warming. I looked at the panel. Not one single serious climate scientist specifically dealing with the Arctic was on the panel. Not one. It's just a fraud. Now, I'm not going to play my segment from the UN. I'm going to do both segments tomorrow and to follow that up. I just want to mention this before we go to our guest. And I gave you our guest background. So here's what I want to say. We have already seen increases beyond earlier predictions. Right now, as of today, polar ice melt is at its worst, but also Greenland and Antarctica, and they're beyond the tipping point. We have the fastest loss of glaciers in recorded history. We had the desertification with new dust bowls, including in the southwest United States. If you've never seen the difference between a dust bowl and a sandstorm, take a look, because we also have sandstorms that can rip all the foliage off trees. No news about it. We have more severe wildfires and longer drought periods. We have the worst floods and more frequent hurricanes and typhoons. We have permafrost melting faster, releasing more methane and other greenhouse gases. If you shift in weather zones across the globe, you'll see disruption of the ecological equilibrium and seasons that affect biodiversity. So we're losing about 200 species per day. Sea levels are rising, and that's threatening coastal cities, including New York City. But you wouldn't know it, because nothing's being done. Because the woke generation who control Congress, who control state legislature, who control city councils, it's not a big deal to them. After all, there's more important things to do, like, and we're going to get to that with my guest, especially on the East Coast. 70% of Americans live along the coast, leaving much of the rest of the country uninhabited. Ocean stratification, which is warming, increasing dramatically. Longer heat stays on ocean surface. The warmer the atmosphere above that surface, also less carbon the ocean depths can sequester. Nothing can really be done about that. That's tipped. Oceans are far more powerful forces than humanity and all of our technological sophistications. So as she said, Greta Thunberg just said at Davos, you know, you can't negotiate with physics. The loss of ecological biodiversity, especially the rainforest, the wetlands, the critical sequestering of CO2 and preserving hydraulic cycles, none of that is being done, because every country, including China, wants to get as many resources, whether it's genetically engineered soybeans or hardwoods out of the Amazon, but that's true also of the plantations, the oil exploiting palm plants in Indonesia. Nobody cares. So sticking with the fossil fuel paradigm, hydrofracking, drilling, pipelines, coal mining, requires further destruction of natural lands. Requires an enormous infrastructure that demands natural resources, so only further aggravates the speed of the problem. Rapid loss of water resources, affecting much more than sustainable agriculture, a need to completely overhaul our entire use and distribution of water. We're not evaluating the immense destruction of industrial agriculture, and that's unfortunate. We have lost bees and other pollinators, largely due to reliance on pesticides and industrial agriculture. Fertilizers contributing to the rise of dead zones. We used to have one dead zone, a small one. The last time I filmed it down in the at the opening of the Mississippi at New Orleans, it was not that large. Now it's larger than the state of New Jersey. There's 400 of them out there now. And we're seeing eutrophication of lakes and rivers. So think in the future for allocating of funds to target protective measures without having the public-private cooperation, which means that giant companies that know nothing about the environment will get huge sums of money, keep most of it for themselves, and do diddly squat when it comes to actually serving the environment. That's the problem that the environmental agencies and the environmental corporations have done when they got in bed with the polluters, because they wanted the money. And they got the money. And we got nothing helping the environment except platitudes. That said, let's go now to our guest who's standing by. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Jacoby.
It's good to be here.
I gave your bio a little earlier in the program, including your new book, which I'm hopeful people will read, on diversity, the eclipse of the individual in a global era. By the way, your publisher, Seven Stories, I helped founded Seven Stories Press way back.
Okay.
Well, while I was preparing for this interview, I only came to realize that you have been writing and speaking about identity politics regarding diversity and race and political correctness and the homogenization of our educational institutes 25 years ago. And so I commend you on your early insights into what is now dominating our public, political, and intellectual discourse. And quite frankly, when I look at what is being said about diversity and the various movements for whatever matters that particular week, it sounds like confused thinking and garble. When a book like White Fragility can become a New York Times bestseller and now is demanded reading in many schools, demand that people read it as a way of showing allegiance to a particular ideology, and use this textbook for sensitivity training for employees on college campuses, I have to wonder whether we have gone into a dark zone of our own being. This is the reason why I was eager to bring you on the program, because you have been addressing these topics for a long time and have a very unique perspective on the rhetoric and claims for recognizing diversity in the broader context of democracy and globalization. So please take whatever time you need to lay out your case that the trends we are witnessing today to preserve the diversity are in fact doing quite the opposite and thereby conditioning us into sameness or uniformity. The form is yours.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And in fact, I think I could probably hook up to your previous discussion about climate. I mean, the point is, if one steps back and looks at the entire globe, one can see that diversity is actually diminishing. I mean, biodiversity is diminishing, and I think cultural diversity is diminishing. And this is despite the jargon and ideology that we're becoming increasingly diverse. I think the real processes are the opposite. I mean, we can see through, you know, consumerism, advanced capitalism, you can fill in the blanks here, that people are actually becoming more alike. They are buying in literally to the same stuff, the same ideas. And even as this is a pretty clear trend across the world, I mean, one can call it the mauling of the world, you know, consumer malls or whatever. At the same time, we have this ideology diversity that we're increasingly different, that we're increasingly unique, even though it seems obvious that the real trends are in the opposite direction. We are becoming increasingly similar. We're becoming more homogenous. Our cities look more and more alike. The world's populations dress more alike. Now, these are tendencies. I don't say they're concrete, established facts at this point, but these are the tendencies everywhere. And despite that, we have increasingly celebrated diversity. Even though I say the trends are in the opposite direction. And the only way we can do this is that we empty the terms diversity of real meaning, that they simply become shorthands for groups or ethnicities or religions. And everyone becomes an exemplar of a racial or ethnic or religious group. And that means individuality also begins to vanish as we see people simply as representing a group. So my concern has always been that diversity and multiculturalism become empty slogans. And it's not as if diversity in itself is a bad. On the contrary, it's good, but we have to have open eyes to what is happening in the world, and we're losing diversity. We lose it in we're losing biodiversity, and we're losing cultural diversity. And at the same time as this happens, we are celebrating it as if it's expanding. And I say the only way we can do that is if we really empty these terms of any meaning. And, you know, that they become shorthands or they become slogans, but they don't have any real content. And this we see endlessly. Diversity officers, diversity programs, what are they actually doing? How diverse are these people? How diverse is everyone? So I raise questions about the jargon of diversity, I suppose, in an age of homogenization. How can these two things coexist? And they can only coexist if we empty diversity of meaning and it becomes a slogan or just, you know, rhetoric, which we see everywhere today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Who are the arbiters that define what this sameness should be in that people are unconsciously aligning themselves to? Is there another agenda being played out in terms of neoliberal capitalism? Have they tried to put a pretty face on neoliberal capitalism? And what role does the internet and social media play in creating a kind of faux diversity?
Diversity, again, is it neoliberal capitalism? I mean, we have diverse offerings in the marketplace. We have different detergents. We have different items to choose from. Those differences are not to be sneered at, but they become smaller. Now, the question of the internet and social media, I think certainly has probably acerbated some of these faux differences. Now, this is not to say that there are not political differences in the world and political differences between left and right. And one might say, in certain ways they increase, but in other ways they certainly don't. And if you really look at political differences, and this I think is certainly on the left what are the ideas of a left today in the world? Well, the ideas of diversity, for instance, don't take you one very far. Is that an idea of a different society, or is it simply an idea of representation of different groups in the consumer, let's say, neoliberal order? And it's more the latter. I mean, people want representation in the same society. They share the same ideas of success. They're sharing the same ideas of consumption. One can recognize, one doesn't have to criticize that in the sense that everyone should or deserves to have success in the world. But as a left program, as a program of changing the world. It suggests that's been surrendered, and all we can offer is better representation of different groups in the same neoliberal order. And it seems to me that's a surrender. I mean, that's a loss of vision of what a different society could be for. And again, we see this everywhere. I mean, it seems to me that the political differences, as wide as they are, we're talking about representation, how different groups can be represented in the same society without really making fundamental changes.
I would agree with that. On a recent program, I briefly presented some of the ideas of Alexis de Tocqueville, the French statesman who wrote his analysis of the fledgling United States in the early 19th century. You show how he and John Stuart Mill both have something to teach us about the paradoxes between democracy, the rights of the individual, and the equality and their decline in PBS, NPR, Fox. They are all wanting their viewers to understand that there is only one truth. There are ideological, political truths. So they want people to conform. The other end of that is that if you don't conform, you are erased, you're shamed, you're censored, and then on Wikipedia, you're destroyed. I've never seen a more loathsome organization than Wikipedia. It's not a legitimate encyclopedia. I've written 72 articles, scholarly articles, against Wikipedia, what has become from its original ideal. So what, when you look around today, what are the main lessons that these two individuals long ago, when they observed America, what can we learn from them, and especially involving these new movements, for whatever happens that in a particular month or a particular, you know, election cycle, there's a truth that exceeds it and a truth that precedes it. What did they know that we're not willing to learn today?
I think the great liberal thinkers of the 19th century, yes, John Stuart Mill and Tocqueville and others, did see and did fear what was happening, which is that the individual was losing his or her individuality. And this was the great threat that Mill raised, you know, that on one hand, there is the question of dissent, certainly, and the right of dissent. But almost more fundamental is that in order to dissent, you have to have a robust individual, a robust individuality. And Mill and Tocqueville raised the specter of, well, what happens if we have freedom and democracy, but we don't have sort of the robust individuality which will allow differences? What happens if conformity, we all agree and dissent becomes less, I mean, it's not outlawed, but we don't have real dissent because we lack, you know, sort of the individual backbones which supported it. And Mill and Tocqueville, were pretty clear that they saw this as the threat in the future, that we were becoming more conformist. Now, again, the ideology is certainly the opposite. We're more individual. We have more individuality than ever. Expressed how? It's expressed in our music choices, our consuming choices, in our automobile choices. But again, this is a sort of a limited vision of individuality. And I think we see this criticism, emerging in the middle of the 19th century with Mill and Tocqueville, as they see this new democratic society emerging, and they begin to fear that people are going to conform more than they're going to really protest and stand up for something different. And I think these are the clear lessons that we can draw from Mill and de Tocqueville, which have been basically lost or at least shunted aside.
I would agree with that. I'm going to mention some names to you just off the top of my head, and it's by no means conclusive that these are the only ones, but Chris Hedges, Bill Moyers, Ralph Nader, Daniel Ellsberg, Mickey Huff, Glenn Greenwald, Glenn Ford, also Max Blumenthal, Ben Norton, Aaron Maté, Matt Taibbi, Harvey Wasserman, John Curacao, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Ray McGovern, John Pilger, Lee Camp, Jimmy Dore, Tom Hartman. I would add in Whitney Webb, Helen Bissinnick, Caitlin Johnstone, who's on our show later this week, Abby Martin, Ellen Brown, Margaret Kimberly, Julian Assange. Those are just some, a small sample of individuals who I believe if we had a chance to hear their messages, see them in debates, have open and honest forums to discuss these issues, we would have a different and possibly a more optimistic view of the future. Every one of the names I just mentioned has been shamed, attacked, deplatformed by the left. What does that tell you about the real differences between the traditional liberal and today's corporate liberal, as is the difference between a traditional conservative and a corporate conservative today?
Well, you raise some good questions. I don't know I'd use the same lingo, but certainly I've been, as much as you or other people, have been concerned that the traditional defense of free speech, which was once a left position, has been surrendered. And somehow we've moved to the direction that words should be censored and we can try to stop people. And it seems to me that's a terrible mistake. But we see it. We see it emerging everywhere. That the historic relationship between a left and free speech is weakening, if not has been reversed. And I know I've seen it on college campuses that the defenders of free speech are not conservatives, and that's bizarre. I mean, this has been a complete reversal, and it's a left which has increasingly demanded that certain peoples be stopped. And it certainly raises issues about what one anticipates could happen. I mean, who was to decide who should speak and who should not speak? And the left has traditionally been distrustful of giving that right to the state. But now we see it as, yes, well, we want corporations and the state to stop certain people from speaking. And it seems to me that's a terrible mistake, which will come to haunt.
I believe you're correct. By the way, we just want to say that we are going to be signing off from our WBAI so they can complete their program today with the news. We are continuing on PRN.FM, and my guest is Professor Russell Jacoby, and we're talking about censorship and freedom of speech and the woke generation. When you identify globalization as one of the more powerful forces that has been undermining and eroding the preservation of diversity, we see this in the collapse and loss of indigenous cultures, when multinational corporations operating under free trade impinge on their homelands. However, I've been following and researching this great reset that is being launched at this very moment by the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab's group, and its wide network of transnational firms and banks and tech companies. Quite simply, in my opinion, this is a new generation of globalization on steroids. which would have been unthinkable several decades ago and before the technologies that we now have are in such control. So based upon what you have shared, this global uniformity will be accelerating dramatically, and diversity will be even further lost because technology has no concern about who or what a person is. They don't care about your race or ethnicity or gender. That's irrelevant to them. They don't care whether you're offended by a concept or a word or dress. That is meaningless. They're looking at how they can get rid of the workforce, and they're not hiding this. They're talking about automation in almost 80% of all the fields right now that people had historically thought they could work in for the rest of their life. Those are going to be gone in the next 5 to 10 years, gone completely. And it'll simply render everyone as a potential revenue stream, a commodity, based upon the data collected on everyone. Do you have any thoughts on this, please?
Well, I tend to agree. I mean, I think the major trends in the globe are a kind of globalization and homogenization. And this is true of the natural world, which, again, you talked about previously, and the loss of biodiversity. And it's going to be true in the human world, the loss of cultural diversity. There are parallel trends. The paradox only is, which is the one I talked, is that at the same time, we have the ideology of diversity accelerating as the reality diminishes, which is a bit extraordinary. So we celebrate how different we are as we become more similar. And yes, and as the corporate global network gets tighter, we celebrate how different we are, which the two don't go together, basically. And yes, I think these are the major trends in the globe today, this global industrialization, homogenization, the loss of smaller cultures and individual sectors, which get weaker and begin to disappear. One of the things I talk about in the book is you could see it even in languages, the loss of languages and the supremacy of certain languages. These are the real tendencies. And we don't really recognize it when we simply celebrate diversity endlessly, as we do.
I'm seeing the world today, at least in the United States, in shades of Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, when we have Homer's The Iliad being banned, and he and other classicists are judged as racist or patriarchal by some teachers who clearly don't understand their writings. We're having book burnings and book bannings, and teachers like the extraordinary teacher, Professor Mark Crispin Miller, at New York University's Communications Department, got pillared by his students, demanding his expulsion. The university's administration started to side with the students for political expediency, to stay on the protected side of the students. So now the students control the classroom, and the administrations don't want the hassle, so they're putting layer upon layer upon layer of diversity people in administrative positions. It's everything seems to have run amok. Your final thoughts on this, please.
Well, again, I tend to agree that we're not a particularly great phase here. And the ideology of diversity, to the extent it's being institutionalized, it does exact a certain kind of conformity. I mean, that you're supposed to agree and represent your group or ethnicity. You're supposed to agree with certain positions. It's the irony of diversity. It's in fact enforcing a kind of conformity. And I think this is very troubling. And we see this throughout the states and throughout the campuses, that as diversity gets institutionalized, it demands a certain kind of conformity, and which is being is a heavy price to pay. And it's part of the irony of this ideology.
I appreciate your work, and we're happy that you're still able to teach and write and have an audience, because your words are relative today more than ever before. So we thank you for being you and on your new book on diversity, The Eclipse of the Individual in a Global Era, Seven Stories Press. Thank you, Professor Russell Jacoby, for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a
pleasure. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.